Welcome to Combat Sports Talk, a podcast dedicated to UFC and Bellator discussion, the MMA community, and combat sports in general. I'm your host, Ryan Smith, and joining me this week is the entire Combat Sports Talk crew. We got John Keys.
Yes, you do. Hey, everybody. How's it going tonight?
All right. We've got Kelechi Onyebuchi.
Wakanda for
The power of the Black Panther has been stripped away.
Oh my God.
And we got George Stallworth.
What's up, baby boy?
All right. Well, we are excited. I can't speak for you guys, but I am excited to be here. We had an amazing week of fights, starting back last Saturday with UFC 249. Then we had the UFC Fight Night in Jacksonville, Anthony Smith versus Glover Teixeira on Wednesday. And then we finished up with Alistair Overeem versus Walt Harris last Saturday. It was amazing. And so one of the things I want to do is I want to get right into the headliner, because we're going to talk about the impact of three fights in 7 days. Here we go with the headliner. Headliner. This is where we talk about the number one story in the MMA world today, and it is Dana White. Uncle Dana pulled it off. He got three fights, not one, not two, not three. He was the only act in town. There were no other sporting events taking place except the action that was going on in Jacksonville, Florida. And so I got to say it. He said he could do it. The man did it.
Also, I hate the notion of calling him Uncle Dana. Like, it feels creepy. It's almost as creepy as, what's the other guy's name?
Uncle Creepy? Yeah.
Yeah. Uncle anything just feels uncomfortable.
But see, when I hear it, it reminds me of Uncle Fester from the Addams Family.
He is bold.
but you know, I got that crazy uncle like Dana White that talks crazy. You know, he'll say some of the most outlandish things, and somehow, some way, he pulls it off. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm good with.
Well, that's the thing. You know, with the specter of coronavirus all over the country, Florida opened their economy for the UFC. Dana White promised that he would be able to get it done in three fights in 7 days. He had one confirmed COVID-19 positive fighter, which was Jacare Souza. And so we start the two-week watch to see if the safety protocols that the UFC implemented and all of the disinfecting that they did between each fight paid off in three fights, three cards, with no new coronavirus infections. That's the thing we've got 2 weeks to watch.
I don't know if that becomes the barometer of success for this thing. So if you'll see, they've already done a job, I wouldn't say a good job, but a job of kind of sweeping under the rug the fact that they did have a case. And then whenever it comes up, saying that the fighters are saying that the testing from Wednesday to the next Saturday was vastly different, and they've made implementations to better improve their quality of it. So like in the past, if there was a fighter that was hurt before a main card, we would have heard about it, and like we'd have been following the progress and how they're doing their recovery. Then in this case, you've got a fighter who's sick, like of something that can be life-threatening, depending on your viewpoint, but can be life-threatening. And the next day, when Ariel Helwani was asked about it, they're like, we don't know where he is. He's probably back home. Florida's, he trains not too far from here, so he probably drove home. Like, people just forgot about him and focused on the sport. A little weird, but I mean, I get that they want to minimize the impact of it, because really where they should be judged is what he did, what Dana did really well. He normalized an empty stadium in a sport that has been all about fan reactions. And I think he succeeded in that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised, because we were all wondering what was it going to be like, and we were kind of weirded out the first time we saw a fight with no audience. But once we got into these 3 days of or three cards over 7 days, in a way, I kind of like it. I like being able to hear the action and hearing them talking to each other back and understanding what they're saying, going back and forth to each other. That's what's crazy. So, you know, for George, John, did you guys have any comments on the fact that, you know, as far as we know, there have been no incidents, and we're now in that countdown of 14 days.
I'm gonna hold my response until the end of the 14 days. I want to see the full reaction. I'm not gonna be the one to say, "All right, Dana did it. UFC got it back. They're back." No, I'm not gonna do that. I'm happy that they did pull it off. Like Casey said, I'm happy that they actually normalized one-on-one combat without a giant crowd there. It's actually, I prefer it. And I'm kind of curious on how it's going to be when the crowd comes back, all right, if anything. And I'm going to see I'm going to try and do all my research I can on what happened to Jacare. You know, if there's any news, because I am curious to see how he's doing.
All right, George.
This was a big win for the UFC. This was a big win for WME. This was a big win for ESPN. This was a win for anyone who's interested in combat sports in general, man. To be able to say you pulled off an event and the one person that tested positive, more than likely came there positive, had a story that lined up with why he was positive and was not something that affected the rest of the card, the rest of the fighters. Even though right now, you're right, we're not within that 14-day window to know for sure, but when it's all said and done right now, what people will remember is that this event went off unhinged, uninterrupted, and without any major issues whatsoever. If you want to speak to the issues, I'm sure we're going to go in that later on. Some of the issues were more like referee stoppages and judges scoring, but that's a whole different topic. But all in all, the UFC pulled off basically a masterpiece of a weekend, not even a weekend, a masterpiece of a three-fight show.
Yep. And so now it comes to, there are more fights that they have planned that they want to set up. June 6th looks like it's the next time they're going to have a big event. And so the UFC said if Las Vegas doesn't reopen, which it doesn't look like they're planning on reopening yet, they're going to move the shows to Arizona, because Arizona is now reopening and they are looking to court the UFC in a way that is that's going to bring them to that state. Fighter pay continues to be a contentious point in the MMA world. And so when we're looking at UFC 249, it sold 700,000 pay-per-views at $65 a piece. I know that I believe all four of us bought. That's $45 million. But payouts to fighters were only about $3.5 million. So it was 12% of the generated revenue. So, you know, we were talking about this on the Intelligent Defense discussion group on Facebook. Like, what does that mean about fighters' pay? I mean, that's a lot of money coming into the UFC coffers. KC, I see you doing the Dougie here.
My collective bargaining conversation once again pops its little head into this conversation about there absolutely needs to be some sort of... There has to be a reckoning with the UFC, because fighters are getting better pay in other organizations. Sure, you don't get as much name, but even across those other organizations, there's no real standard for what percentage of the purse each fighter gets. And the thing that kills me about the fighter pay conversation is, well, they'll say, well, this person's able to sell fights better, but they don't factor in the fact that the UFC picks certain fighters to put marketing dollars behind. So the rich get richer, while the guys who are busting their butt winning fights still are making less than school teachers. And that's not a knock on school teachers. I feel like they're underpaid. Let me just throw that out there. But I was thinking,
why you hate school teachers? What?
Because sometimes school teachers have to become MMA fighters, and then they get movies made about them.
Yes, they do.
Rich Franklin.
Rich Franklin
comes to mind. Yes.
So,
I want to add another caveat. Okay. I want to play the devil's advocate on it.
All right.
So very often these fighters come into these fights and there is a contract that is lined up well in advance. So very often, like this weekend, not this weekend, but this past 10 days of fights, a lot of those fighters' pay were determined based upon their contract that was agreed upon well in advance of this actual fight, them being offered the fight. And things like that. Right. And so this goes back to having good management and someone putting things in your contract. So let's say we know right now it doesn't look like MMA fighters are going to get a union. If anyone should be unionizing, it should be the management and managers of MMA fighters who are in a better position to fight on behalf of their fighters. We've seen the way that this talk of unionizing the fighters themselves has gone. It hasn't gone well. So I think in the absence of that, now we should be looking at management in order to fix this fighter pay issue.
I like it. That's a path I hadn't considered before, and it's got a lot of potential. I wonder if it would stifle the ability for new fighters to even get in with a manager who has an in to the UFC, because that's already a weird gatekeeping system that they have to even get in. As you're aware, like just getting into the UFC, there's a little bit of who knows who going on, and not really just about talent and being at the right place. It's having the right type of management. And if there's another gate there where I have to work with a unionized manager who may not be by union rules allowed to talk to a fighter out of Oklahoma City, even though I have a relationship with them, then I may never make it to the show. But I like that twist because it does change the conversation. Well, it shifts the dynamic of power, and that's what really needs to happen right now in the UFC. Because you're right, these fighter contracts are months in advance designed, but that means that months ago it was still the wrong pay structure, because the UFC should have like a minimum amount that's reasonable for a young fighter to come in. If I only get two fights a year, I should still be able to make a livable wage with two fights a year, because a lot of these guys aren't getting a lot. So there's a lot of restructuring that needs to happen and can happen. There's so much wiggle room. It's the UFC is not really bleeding money.
Well, I think it comes down to whether or not the UFC sees it as something that it is the right thing to do. Like we all see it as the right thing to do is to pay the fighters more. But at the end of the day, they are the biggest brand. They are the draw. That's the place where you can go. If you want to make more money, you can always go to ONE FC. You can always go to Bellator. But if you want to fight the best in the world, if you want to have the biggest stage, then, you know, you are going to fight for the UFC. And you're going to take whatever it is, because there's so many fighters in the MMA world that it's a supply and demand type of thing. And so if you are an up-and-coming fighter and you don't have any notoriety and you're just... you're just fighting on the regional circuit, then why should they pay more for you when you don't have a following, when there is someone who has a tremendous following bringing millions of people into the pay-per-views and the arenas are all around the world? Those fighters are more valuable. It's the same thing in the NFL, and they do have a union. There is a minimum, but at the same time, some players are paid more, some players are paid less. And so Will Flo, he's watching here on Facebook, and he's saying the UFC is making billions off of our dreams. And it's true. It is true that they are, but there has to be a point in time where the UFC has to say, we're doing the wrong thing. Otherwise, there is no incentive, because they have the power structure, that they operate the power structure.
It hurts your farm system. So I look at it as, everyone here knows I'm a nerd, so I can only speak in it from my standpoint. So I look at, there was a time where there was this notion of apprenticeships in networking and those type of security hands-on IT jobs. So there are these apprenticeships where you work alongside with someone, learn it, and then you move into like high mid-tier management type role. Then they came along with, well, we've got all this college talent that we need to put to work, so we'll do internships. They did a lot of unpaid internships. And then you had these notions of paid internships, which I did. I got paid a ton as an intern. And what we started to see is that the companies that were paying their intern, paying a great wage for their interns, were able to retain that talent longer and keep all of that knowledge and investment in it. Whereas if you just get people out here working for the experience of, hey, I'm working for a Fortune 100 company, that's cool on my resume, you get burnout and you lose every bit of value that you had in that intern, because they're going to take that to another company.
But the UFC, you're doing that with experiencing the UFC. That's not happening at the UFC.
Well, actually, I'm going to disagree with you, Ryan. So the UFC does have an internship type program. It's called Dana White's Contender Series.
Yeah.
And this is where they're starting to build fighters up, and they're catching these fighters before they have a chance to really talk to high level management and make some real decisive decisions when it comes to what they feel they're worth, their net worth, and their input into this sport. So although the Dana White Contenders, don't get me wrong, it is a great platform to bring new talent into to UFC. But it also shows this new talent to Dana, WME, and all these folks before this talent has had a chance to mature, decide on career path, and decide on what I'm worth. And it's also a way to negate you going to other promotions, because I'd rather be on the Contender Series than to go take a fight at Bellator. On the Contender Series, I'm going to get seen in a much higher volume or whatever. The UFC does that well. They will put you out there on a platform. They will build you if you've got the right components behind you. Bellator can't do that. You can't really name many fighters at Bellator who have built a brand there, and you just know off the top of your off your brain. You know those fighters in the UFC. You know and then you know those guys who get the push from the UFC. Tell me somebody who's getting a push from Bellator.
Michael Venom Page. Paul Daly.
Paul Daly is not.
But what I'm getting to you is, you don't hear Michael Venom Page's name daily in your regular life. You hear of Conor McGregor.
Yeah.
You hear what I'm saying? You hear of John Jones. You hear of all these guys at the UFC.
They're both thugs, to be honest. But I do dispute. We got so much show that we have not even gotten to yet. But I think this is a healthy debate. It always is when we start talking about fighter pay and equality within the discrepancy of how much money the UFC is bringing in and how much money is coming to the fighters. I think it's always a topic that is worth discussing, and I hope we continue to have it. But we got to get to the official decision, because, you know, while we're celebrating that there were three fights in 7 days, there were actually, you know, a ton of action that is worth talking about. So let's get into it. This is the official decision. All right, this is the official decision. This is where we look at the results from Wednesday and Saturday night. We had a lot of fights going on. The first one that we are going to do is the fight, Anthony Smith versus Glover Teixeira. This was Wednesday, May 13th. It was at the ViStar Veterans Memorial Arena in Jacksonville, Florida. There were five fights on the card, and this is a new thing that we're testing out today, thanks to Kelechi. Here it is. Boom.
I will say this one is thanks to our listeners. We're listening to you. Thanks for the advice. This one comes from Jessica.
All right. So this is the card. Carl Roberson and Marvin Vettori, those guys were scratched because Carl Roberson had a bad weight cut. Vettori confronted Carl Roberson in the lobby, and there was almost an altercation. Lots of obscenities were yelled at each other. And I really can't blame either guy. I can't blame Carl Roberson because the cut was tough. But Marvin Vettori has been through a lot, and he still hasn't had a chance to fight. Remember, this is the guy back at UFC London who flew to London and then had to fly back to the United States and then had to fly back, and he didn't get to fight, and they held a fight down the street with fighters from his card.
My dude is legit looking for a fight at this point.
Like, yes, he can fight anywhere, anytime.
Man.
That's wild. I can't blame him. Like, I totally get that. I'd be livid.
Yeah, and he was. And so I don't blame him for it, but that's what happened. Andre Arlovski defeated Philippe Lenz via unanimous decision. That was a great fight. Andre Arlovski is still, after all these years, still putting it down.
Is he like 40 yet? I think he's 40.
They were like 42.
42, yeah. That's what I was thinking. He's 42.
He's in his 40s. That's a verifiable fact. You can search for that one.
Great jiu-jitsu there.
Yes, sir.
No, I thought he was getting ready to. Like, I'm watching him. I see his arms reach for the keyboard. I'm like, oh, he's going to search that. And then he's like, yeah, I guess he's 42.
No, I'm, like, I'm looking it up. I'm looking it up right now. Sweet Baby Jesus in the Manger. I'm looking it up.
Yeah. But Sweet Christmas. What was interesting is they were saying that Andrei Arlovsky followed the game plan. And when you follow the game plan, good things happen. And so even though Philippe Lenz was a faster striker, you know, Andrei Arlovsky used that veteran cunningness and pulled that one out. It was a very close fight, but I'm glad that Andrei Arlovsky pulled it out.
Yeah, he's 41, by the way.
There you go.
I'm really good at guessing ages. Look, leave me alone. Just next one.
Ricky Simone defeated Ray Borg via split decision. What a barn burner that was. That fight was back and forth. When you get those little 135-pound, 125-pound guys, I know they were 135-pound in this fight, but Ray Borg was fighting at 125 before the division went defunct. They were great. And Ricky Simone, that is a big 135er. He could probably be fighting at 145 and still be handling his own.
Yeah, that was a definite phone booth battle. They were fast. They were brutal. But in the end, never leave the decision in the hands of the judges. You will not get your way, especially in Florida. Florida has proven too many times that I don't know which fight they were watching, but, you know, they will mess it up.
For our fighters, our listeners who aren't as well-versed in boxing terminology or fighting terminology, could you elucidate what you meant by phone booth?
We know what you say, elucidate
say that word
means.
Again that you
we
just said, though.
Elucidate.
What? Yeah, he used
hold
that.
Hold on.
Spell it.
I got to elucidate.
I got you.
That one is in my vocabulary.
I'm going to make this a weekly showstopper.
Elucidate. A verb. Make something clear or explain. He's gonna make me smart, people.
Okay. That's right. Listen, we promote this podcast as a smart and funny podcast. This now we have checked the box on smart. Elucidate.
But real quick though, for real though, when you say it was a phone book fight, a phone booth fight, what does that mean?
That means that the fighters were so close to each other they did not tend to run or anything like that. They were literally so close to each other and swinging on each other that you could have fit that fight into a phone booth and still got the same results.
So what Kelechi's really saying is what is a phone booth? Because I mean, only us old guys know what a phone booth is.
Watch the original Superman 1978. That's all I got to say.
I mean, I was training boxing. We just put tires in there, and you both had one foot in the tire.
There you go.
All right. Old school style.
Yeah, Drew Dober defeated Alexander Hernandez. Alexander the Great via TKO in the second round. Talk about another great fight. Alexander Hernandez was moving, striking, sticking, and moving, but Drew Dober was not going to be denied, and he put it on Hernandez. Put the Texas boy down.
You know, I know he's from Texas and everything, but was I the only one that was kind of satisfied with that, with Alexander getting the molly whopped out of him?
I mean,
I didn't have any animus against him.
I don't have any animosity, but you know, sometimes when you have a chip on your shoulder, it's got to get knocked off a little bit, just a little bit.
What are you saying about Mr. Hernandez?
Oh, I'm just saying.
You want to square up with him?
Yeah, that's what it's not. Yeah. No, he's from Texas. It's not like, you know, he's in Minnesota somewhere. He's literally right down the street.
Put some respect on his name.
So keep
All I'm saying is I'll take him before I take Mike Tyson. Okay. Or I'll take him before I take Mike Tyson. I'll take him and Mike Tyson at the same time before I take Ngannou. Okay. That's just all I'm saying.
Well, I mean, yeah. Yeah, I think I would take my chances with Hernandez before I would take my chances with Mike Tyson or Francis Ngannou.
More likely to see Hernandez before you see Mike or Ngannou.
Yeah.
And Hernandez, don't get me wrong, don't run up on me, but if you do, man, it is what it is. The thing was that when you first came on the scene, I understand having confidence. I understand having drive. But you also had a bit of cocking, a little bit too much cocking. cockiness, and he just had to be knocked down just a notch. And Drew Dober, hopefully, is the guy that did it. Hopefully, you level off and you go back there with your drive, not much of the chip.
Well, so that, I mean, I think that that's fair. Drew Dober, even though he looks like a frat daddy, he does he does seem to be a bit more humble than other fighters that we know. In the co-main event, Ben Rockwell, there we go.
Say it like you mean it.
Big Ben defeated Ovince St. Preux via split decision. I didn't think it was a split decision. I didn't see Ovince St. Preux winning anything, really. Maybe the last round. The last round he came up kind of strong, but he really disappointed me in how slow he started, how he was kind of lazily throwing punches, how he was just moving around the ring and just taking just some big shots from Ben Rothwell. Like, dude, you are the more athletic dude. Like, we shouldn't have gone to the judges.
It's weird that you've got the belt holder, light heavyweight belt holder, and John Jones eyeing OSP's move up to heavyweight as a potential roadmap to what it's going to be like fighting at that weight. Just because the two have matched up before, and John Jones is clearly the superior fighter. So it's strange that John is looking at that. But when you look at what Ovince brought to the ring, like, there's always that question of, are you going to be slower when you pack on the extra pounds? And in this case, it's hard to tell because OSP is always a slow fighter when it comes down to it. But in this case, it wasn't even about the quickness of his punches. It was how fast he was going to run around the ring, because that man was literally running from punches. He was He didn't look like he was in any way, shape, or form prepared to be a heavyweight.
Well, I don't know what to say. I watched this fight as well. And what I do know is that when you are being struck, it tends to tax your cardio a lot more than people anticipate. And so that move up for him, he's being hit by a heavyweight now. And that drains on your meter a lot more than, say, a John Jones hitting on you. I'm not not saying that you get what I'm saying, in that you got bigger guys hitting on you. And those shots count more as far as your cardio, especially if they're going to the body and hitting you in the body or putting their weight on you and things like that. So in that sense, I can see why he was having some cardio problems. He might not have been properly prepared for that. And again, we're going back to these fight cards were set up very quickly. Like, we don't know how long OSP really got to train for this. And we've always known that he's not at a big camp. He's not somewhere where he's getting top level training. He's not at a Winkle Johns, or he's not at a CSA, or he's not at a Dark Side MMA.
Yeah, I was getting ready to say it. He's not getting trained. Ovince St. Preux, if you are listening, if anyone listening knows Ovince St. Preux, go see George. Well, he is
Ryan. He's your frat brother. You should be calling him out and telling him to come see me in Texas. Quit playing.
Oh.
Matt, what you got to say about that?
Oh yeah, he went loud.
Yeah, I'm going there.
Silence and to the side. At least
he's not saying you gotta fight him. It's just an
OSP. Be out, bro. Be out. Come on. Come on out to Texas.
He should. He should come out. Look. I'll start sending some words around. Well, you know. Hopefully he's financial. Anyway.
A lot of people don't get that.
I think what's important reclamation there is also in that fight, it had more movement in the heavyweight division, right? So it was the start of the conversations, or restarting that conversations, about the fact that the heavyweight title is locked up with their champion choosing not to fight right now.
And we're going to cover that if we get to it in the show, because we've been we've been taking our good sweet time through this run sheet, but that's all right, because it's good conversation. In the main event of the evening, Glover Teixeira defeated Anthony Lionheart Smith via TKO in the fifth round. This was a murder fest from round three, where Anthony Smith got hit in in the eye. And then it just led to him getting beaten down more and more and more until the fifth round, at which time they finally stopped this fight. Let's not get too much into the stopping of the fight, because I want to cover that in Fighting the Angles. That'll be the first thing that we'll talk about. But just, are you shocked at Glover Teixeira being able to pull this out? I mean, I thought this was probably going to be the end of his career if Anthony Smith had pulled off what he started out doing.
I saw a lot of good head movement. He didn't look as slow as everyone tried to make it seem. Like, George, I think you and I were doing live at that time, weren't we? Talking through that fight.
Yep.
And it seemed pretty clear that even in the second round, like, Glover was doing a good job of keeping his head off the center line and avoiding the big shots from Anthony. And it was just a matter of time. It looked like he was taking some shots, but he was going to wait out Anthony throughout the fight. So I'm impressed by it's just that fight IQ is really showing itself there. And he's one of these fighters who's oddly getting better with age.
He's like a fine wine.
Well, we know, especially the bigger weights tend to do better as they get older. Your lighter weights don't tend to stick around long because there's a speed component at the lighter weight that outclasses guys as they get older. Whereas in heavyweight, you've developed what's called old man strength. A lot of you don't know nothing about that, but I'll tell you about it one day. Anyway, that old man strength tends to keep you around a little bit longer, man, and it lets you do some things that a lot of people don't expect you to be able to do at those bigger weights, man. And it's for real. I think we're going to start seeing that more and more with John Jones, which is why he's eyeing that move up to heavyweight. Because if you look at John in his last fight, he looked a little...
Yeah.
I'm not one to talk. He looked a little pudgy around the waistline. And I mean that with the most respect, John, because maybe I'll see you one day. But what I'm saying to you is, as a larger weight guy, as I've gotten older, I noticed that old man strength does come into play.
Yeah.
You're going to walk over, but you're going to limp back.
You're going to limp back, young man.
All right. Well, that is it for the first fight on Wednesday night. And then there was Overeem versus Harris. This was also at the ViStar Veterans Memorial Arena on Saturday night, May 16th. There were five fights on that card as well. Song Yadong was in action. I didn't know that he was training out of Team Alpha Male.
Really? He's always been there. That's one of Uriah Faber's proteges, if anything.
So speaking of, I don't know if you guys knew this, but he had some visa issues, apparently, and Uriah Faber almost stepped in on behalf of him.
That's why
he weighed in.
Yes, right. He weighed in.
Right,
he did. Everybody was wondering, why was he weighing in? Mm-hmm. But now we know. No one's half the battle.
There it is. It was a great fight. If you haven't seen this fight, Kelechi, I know that you said you hadn't had a chance to see this one. Go back and watch it. The second round, I think it was the second round between Song Yadong and Marlon Vera, was just lightning. I mean, this whole fight was another one of those, as John was saying, it was a fight in a phone booth. But this one was, I mean, it was everything you wanted to see in a fight. It was super good. Christoph Jotko defeated Eric Anders via unanimous decision. In this fight, Christoph Jotko was really just the more technical fighter. Eric Anders really has a style that tries to get you up against the cage, grapple with you, get this fight on the ground, or land some big shots as you're disconnecting or coming away from that. But unfortunately, Eric Anders was not able to execute with his game plan, and so therefore, Christoph Jotko basically took him apart.
That's been a problem for Eric Anders for a while in his last few fights, where he seems to be outclassed by his opponent, and that's exactly why I didn't pick him in this fight.
So, yeah, anybody else have something on that one?
You know, I picked Eric Anders in this fight, man, and I was not expecting him to get outclassed in that way. But we also saw it with, who's the guy he fought? He's been training over in Thailand. I can't remember the name now, but we
yeah, I know what you're talking about,
I wish I could remember his name. I don't. Yes, Khalil Roundtree. This fight reminded me of that. Fight. Oh, happy about yourself. Look at you. You dropping names and stuff now. Just call your frat bro OSP and tell him I said come to Texas. That's what you need to do. But anyway, back to the point, man. Eric is another one I think could definitely benefit from maybe not a switch in camps, but I'd really like to know who he's training with. From what I understand, he's out of Alabama. So he's probably not at the best place for him right now. And there's nothing wrong with staying true and loyal to your original coaches, but it doesn't mean you can't cross train and pick up new skills from different places. And he strikes me as one of those guys that it's time for him to go pick up some new skills from some different places.
I've seen him at Factory X very rarely. And even then, it seems like he's kind of on his own program. He's not really working well with the striking coaches that are there. It's not that there's like a difference, but he's kind of got his own set agenda. And that's common for fighters to still bring in their own coaches when they're visiting other gyms. But Eric Anders, like having seen him train up close and personal, he does need like a switch in his program to really, he's got to fundamentally change his game if he wants to be competitive at this level. His style just is not working for him. I'd say he's similar to OSP in that sense.
It's easy to be figured out.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
He's not a tough puzzle to solve. I don't know why I can't talk tonight, gentlemen.
So in the next fight of the night, Dan Ige defeated Edson Barboza. Fight looked like it was going to be all Edson Barboza. This was his first fight at 145 pounds. Dan Ige was welcoming him into the featherweight division. And to be honest, I'm like, I know when we were watching, we were like, oh, man, Edson Barboza is going to win this fight easily. And then the second round happened. Eric Anders turned the gas on, and he never looked back. Dan Ige turned the gas on. I'm sorry. We were saying Eric Anders. Dan Ige turned the gas on and never looked back. And so it was a wonderful fight. Good back and forth. And you know, I wonder what Edson Barboza is going to do now, because it's like
that weight cut was too much.
Yeah,
he got ragdolled in some of these like there's a big takedown where he just gets like he's flying in the air like this.
Like, oh. Like those guys in front of the car dealership.
The balloon man. Like, man, he needs some milk.
You know, so you're saying the weight cut was too much? Looking at him, I didn't think that, because I've seen him a little bit more cut up at 155 than he looked at 145. He actually looked like he still had weight he could lose at 145, I felt like.
That's wild.
I didn't think he looked all that drawn up. I didn't think he looked all that bad. In fact, I felt like there was still not a lot, but there was body fat on him that could have been dropped down even more.
That's why you can't.
It wasn't like we were looking at his wasn't like we were looking at a six pack on him. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
What'd you say, Casey?
I said, that's why you can't be my coach. I'm fighting at 155 while I walk around at 240.
But you got a five pack that you can cut some more weight. In the highway robbery of the night, it was Claudia Gadella defeating Angela Overkill Hill in a split decision victory. I didn't see it. Angela Hill won this fight. I agree with her. She did work, and she cut up Claudia Gadella. I don't know why they gave that fight to her. That's some highway robbery.
That definitely was the robbery of the night. I wish there was some remedy other than to petition the commissions in a situation like that, man, because it's very rare a commission is going to change the outcome of a judge's scorecard. But there needs to be some recompense for situations like that, man. The rest of the world didn't get it wrong. We got it right. Those three judges got it wrong. If I recall correctly, one of those judges gave all three rounds to Carla.
Claudia.
It was a 30-27 in that fight.
Yeah, and it's crazy. It's crazy to see that. And go ahead, Kelechi. I know you want to tease me. Go ahead.
No, I wasn't going to tease you. I was hitting George with the heat. He had that recompense.
Oh.
Like, I wasn't even going to make fun of your Team Hill over here. Like, I was celebrating rather than hating. I'm trying to be a better person.
All right. Mm. And then in the main event of the evening, Alistair, some call him the Demolition Man, Overeem, defeated the big ticket Walt Harris. And this was Walt Harris's first fight back after the loss of his stepdaughter. And, you know, I think everybody, as much as Alistair Overeem is beloved by most people, except for Kelechi, we all really wanted to see Walt Harris come back and win this fight. And if things worked out the way that they should have, Alistair Overeem was defeated. He was knocked down. He was bloodied. He was beaten. And the fight was not stopped. Walt Harris blew his gas on that exchange at the very beginning of the fight. Alistair Overeem was able to turn that around by the end of the first round. And then in the second round, he was able to finish it off with a TKO in the second round against Walt Harris, sending Walt Harris to the showers without that coveted win. It was pretty sad. I was upset about it because they really should have stopped the fight at the beginning of the fight when Walt Harris had the advantage.
Go ahead. John, looks like you got some there.
All I'm going to say is that the cagey veteran beat the young fighter. That's what it was. This was one of the classier moments, believe it or not, for Alistair Overeem, because usually he can be what's the word I can say without me
bullish.
Being elite? Bullish. We will use bullish tonight. Okay, he can be a bit of a bully. He can be a bit of a an arrogant sod. All right, but this was one of the more classier moments. That even after he beat him, it wasn't like he had anything bad to say. He had nothing but much respect. He had respect from the get-go when they were told to touch gloves, and he actually went in and hugged him.
Yeah.
You know, it was a good fight. It was a great fight. Anybody watch that fight and watch how good it was. Walt had him. He could have. I really wish he could have finished him.
He did finish him. The ref didn't stop the fight. The fight should have been stopped.
We're gonna talk about that.
Overeem was out when he got rocked. He was out. Like, he went to sleep for a second, rocked off the cage. And what happens when he hit the cage? That woke him back. Right, exactly. Yeah. And I wouldn't even call it a flash knockout. I mean, literally, he goes down. Those eyes are closed. He hits the cage. He opens up, and he's taking more shots and taking more damage. The referee did not step in to stop that fight when it probably should have been.
We're going to talk about that in the next segment because we got stuff to say about Lionheart on that same subject. Should the
ref win? Protect the fighters.
Protect the fighters.
Hashtag there you go. Protect the fighters.
Hashtag when it real goes wrong. Is what it should
let,
be called.
Let me bang, bro. Okay, that's what I...
All right. So there you have it. Those were the fights from Wednesday and Saturday night. Let's go ahead and close the book on this one and put it on the shelf because this one is history now. Let's look at the fight, look at the topics that are making waves in the UFC world with Finding the Angles. All right, this is Finding the Angles. This is where we look at the headlines making waves in the wake of the action on Wednesday and Saturday night. The first thing we're going to talk about is what everyone else is talking about, and that is Anthony Lionheart Smith and the fallout of the brutality of the action on Wednesday night. Anthony Lionheart Smith had to show every ounce of that Lionheart in the mauling that he took from Glover Teixeira. But what really set some people off, at least set me off, and I'll speak for myself, is his comments on the Alistair Overeem and Walt Harris fight. He tweets out, he's trying to watch the fights from the eyes of other people tonight. One guy is hitting another guy a bunch. Is this where we start calling the ref and corners to step in? Also, what point do we get disgusted? Because people have been vocal about Anthony Lionheart Smith's corner for sending him out not just into the fourth round, but in the fifth round, where it is reported that he was injured. His corner knew he was injured. The ref knew he was injured, and no one was stepping in. That he was handing teeth to the referee in the middle of the fight.
Referee just put him in his pocket. It's like, yeah, you'll get him later.
And still we're like, oh, well, that's the sport.
I think there's a lot of problematic issues that go along with this. In that some sense, we praise fighters like Colby Covington whispers to his corner, I think he broke my jaw. Says it clearly twice, sends him out basically to get slaughtered. Like, that could have ended really ugly. In this case, And we've seen this time and time again where they're a fighter. You're in a very different spot as a fighter when you've got your machismo is on the line, right? Like, you don't ever ask a guy, hey, how are you doing in front of, like, a crowd? Because he's never going to tell you the truth because of this false notion of bravery and strength, right? Now, imagine that magnified with millions of people watching and how intimate that setting is, but you've got a camera right here. And if I whisper to my coach that I can't go on, like, that's the only clip that's going to be played over and over and over again. And now somehow that's tied to my manlyhood. Like, as much as we want a fighter to give everything that we've got, what separates this from brutality on the street is that it is a sport and someone's supposed to step in for the good of the fighters. And in this case, you guys know me. I'm a Factory X home team guy and will always speak well of them. But this did not show well for the sport. I understand the notion of my fighter says he wants to go and I'm going to let him go. But what makes this a sport is that we're not actually trying to kill each other. And that was lost in this exchange. The end.
Mic drop. Boom. Locked him.
All right. I guess I'll play the bad guy in this.
All right. There we go. Come on, John Keys.
All right. So
come on with it.
Okay, so if I'm to understand, all right. Lionheart's team knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
Anthony Lionheart knew what they were doing. They both had a plan. Okay. Glover went out there and executed his plan. His plan was to win. Okay. We can't fault neither Lionheart or his team if they both understood what they were going to do. He's going out there, and he is going to fight. He is going to continue to fight. I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying I understand. It is the ref's job to stop that man, okay? It is the ref's job to sit there and say, no, you've had enough. The ref didn't do that. So I'm not mad at Lionheart for doing what he did. I'm not even upset with Lionheart's team because they had an understanding of what was going out there. I mean, losing a couple of teeth. I've seen hockey lose a couple of teeth all the time. Hockey player, I don't think, name me one hockey player that has all of his teeth and has been in the league for 3 years. You can't. With that said, okay, do I think that was a smart plan for Lionheart's team to go out there and let him get beat into some Walmart hamburger meat? No, I do not believe in that. You've never seen Walmart hamburger meat? It's pretty soft. Anyway. But it is what it is.
Joe Exotic over here.
I won't say whose fault it is. I promise you. I'll know whose fault it was. It's the ref. All right. And even then.
Wow. So the corner should never throw in the towel?
Jason.
Not if they have an understanding. If they have an ultimate understanding, they know what they did. Okay. They understand.
Jason Herzog, the referee in that fight, apologized for not stopping it. What he said is that the sport of MMA is beautiful, it's pure, and an incredible teacher. Some lessons are more harsh than others. I've seen a lot of opinions of what should have happened and who was at fault. Let me be clear, there was only one person to blame, me. I am responsible for each fighter I am entrusted to oversee. I will take this experience and make the necessary changes and get better. So Jason Herzog said that it was his fault, but the crazy thing about it is that Anthony Smith comes back and says to that apology is that that's showing weakness. He did not think that Jason Herzog needed to apologize for anything. And that's where Anthony Smith really lost it for me. Like,
it's problematic.
It's not problematic.
We have to stop this Apollo Creed die in the ring kind of mentality. That this is a sport, but it's not a game.
Well, okay. This is the same guy that didn't take the opportunity to win the light heavyweight championship off of an illegal knee. So it's not like this isn't uncommon behavior for him. You get what I'm saying? Like, he's going to stand up on the side of, I want to be a martial artist. And that's what he's saying in that.
So he might as well go train with Brian Ortega and Max Holloway, because they're all... That's just their mentality. I'm not faulting the man for his mentality nor his opinion. Am I saying it's smart? No, I'm not saying it's smart. I'm saying that's how he's wired. The judge better be aware.
It just stands to reason to me that at some point we have got to stop the insanity. When you see it, when you see a fighter gets injured, he gets a clean strike. It clearly a part of the glove went into his eye. He couldn't see, and he stopped defending himself. He wasn't intelligently defending himself. He was taking the damage, basically turtling up the entire rest of the third round. He went back out, and he was not better. He ended up, I mean, it was a 10-7 round. The amount of damage, I haven't seen the stats on it, but I don't believe that Anthony Smith landed any type of offense. It wasn't meaningful if he did. And in that case, you've got to think as the ref, number one, is this fight over? The ref let this go into the fifth round when it shouldn't have. The moment Anthony Smith hands him his teeth and you put it in your pocket, you got to be thinking maybe this fight shouldn't go anymore. The ref is number one to blame for this because he is in control of who the fighters, what's going on in the ring, and protecting the fighters. But when that safety lever fails, then it falls to the responsibility of the corner to say, listen, the ref should be stopping this fight right now. I know that my fighter is beaten. There is no way my fighter can win this fight. And I agree with Chael Sonnen in saying, then it's the corner's responsibility. Now it's my responsibility to say, there's no way we're going to get a flash knockout. This is improbable, but we are getting more and more damage to our fighter. We have to stop the fight. And when that doesn't happen, then it's up to the fighter to say, listen, I got to be real with myself. And if I'm going to be, you know, on a highlight reel, then I've got to say I'm not going back out there.
But when your corner is in the same mentality as you, as we're going to finish this five-round fight, you as the ref it does fall back on the ref to sit there and say, no, you're not going to finish this five-round fight. You are done.
You like to talk about things in terms of street fights. So let's talk about it as a street fight. Let's say that the corners are a group of people and the fighters are two people that got beef. So they meet up in an alley and let's keep the fight the way it's been going. And Smith starts, he starts out good, but then he gets hit so hard that his teeth come out, fly out on the ground. Mm-hmm. Now, you as his group that came with him, you've got options at that point. Like, you got to jump in or at the very least get your guy out. Why is it that in a street fight, we know that that fight's over? We can't let that guy die. But because it's a sport somehow, we differentiate their humanity and say, let them fight on. Because in the street, there is no way that you let somebody's teeth come out on the floor and y'all don't say, hey, y'all got to stop this. Someone's going to die. But we put them in an octagon and we say blood, 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 blood. It's messed up.
Maybe you.
Okay.
Wow. Maybe you say
zero
that.
Empathy coming from John Keyes.
Yo, I don't want
the man with
corner.
The keys to the like bloodbath.
So let's talk a little bit behind the scenes on this.
All right, George has a great perspective here. So let's hear it. Let's hear it.
Okay, let's hear it.
So, from what I understand, Anthony Smith has veneers. So these were not his actual teeth that were being knocked out at that point. These were the veneers being knocked off the caps of his teeth. And from what I understand, this is a very common thing in practice. KC, maybe you could speak to that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, but so from what I understand, when we hear that, hey, he was picking up his teeth and putting them in the referee's hand, these were veneers. And it's not uncommon for a tooth to be knocked out in a fight. In fact, typically the commissions keep a cup of milk somewhere cage side in order to accommodate teeth that are knocked out during a fight. So in that sense, I don't think that's very uncommon. I don't know if you guys knew that or were aware of that.
You say uncommon, but that's still a big deal. As someone who's knocked out another person's tooth on accident, like, it's a lot of force generated when you knock out a person's tooth. And as someone who's had a cap come off, like, those things are meant to be cemented on. Right. Like, that's why DC fights with a tooth that he can take out so that he doesn't even have to worry about it. So, like,
what I guess what I'm saying is,
still a big deal.
I'm not saying it's not a big deal. You're going into a fight. That in its in of itself is a big deal. But these guys know that walking in, and there are precautions set there. And I'm sure that a conversation took place during when fighters are filling out their paperwork saying, hey, I have veneers. Hey, I have these issues. These are things. And so typically a referee should be aware of that beforehand. So when I'm handing you my teeth and you realize, not only that, you realize I've told you already, hey, these are veneers. These, it's not uncommon for these to fall out when I get hit the wrong way. So we're looking at it from our perspective, if it was us.
Fair.
And the truth is we should be looking at it from a perspective of, hey, this is a guy who's gone in and already informed the commission of any ailments he has, any issues he has, any damage that he's already incurred and things like that. And that's what happened in that. So when we hear, hey, he got his teeth knocked out, it's not the whole story, so to speak.
But it's a sign.
Teeth knocked out in a fight, I'm going to be there and stop it. If you get your teeth knocked out in a fight, I promise you this. I'm a pacifist. Everyone knows that. But I'm stepping in there and getting you out.
And that's a commendable for you, KC. But if there is beef.
Yo, I don't want John in my corner. He's been getting murdered.
Yeah. Hey, remember last week.
This was one of those episodes. I'm going to let you talk, but hold on a minute.
Week, George picked John to be his corner man last hold week.
On. Now, let's get this understand. If George says, hey, man, if I take 10 hits, you better be throwing in that towel. You best believe I'm going to throw in that towel because we're on that same weight and the same page. It's all about the page. If the if Lionheart turned around and looked at his corner like, look, we're doing five rounds. I don't care if one of my lungs fall on the floor, I still have another lung to breathe with.
He didn't say that. We know for a fact he did not turn to his corner and say, with all the blood and coming, everything that was happening to him, he did not turn and say, I'm doing five rounds. We know that did not happen. But here's the thing.
We don't know.
The teeth coming out, while it may happen, and there's no way that you should really compare hockey to MMA, but the teeth coming out is just evidence of greater trauma that's happening. The key thing here is that their fighter was still not producing offense. He was turtled up. He was turtled up next to the cage, taking damage, bleeding profusely from his cauliflower ears, and not fighting back. And that's not just at the end of the third round, but it was throughout the fourth round and part of the fifth round. Like, you're watching a guy get beaten in front of you, and he is your guy. All that stuff should go out of the window. All the agreements, hey, don't throw the towel in for me. That's conversation that happens in the locker room. But now things have changed. Clearly, your fighter is injured. You got to do George. Tell me you would have stopped the fight if you were in the corner of Anthony Lionheart Smith that night. You would have stopped that fight. Tell me you would have. Restore my trust.
I have to trust that I know my fighter.
Thank you.
And I make that decision in the moment. If I was working with Anthony Smith and I already know, hey, his teeth fall out because he has veneers. Hey, he bleeds easy because he's got scar tissue above his eyebrow. Hey, he's got a weak chin, but I've seen him take strikes and turn around and turn it like the Overeem. Fight. I've got to take that into account as a coach and when I decide to stop a fight, as opposed to when I see my fighter taking damage that I know is taking years off of his life, not just worried about that moment or that fight. There is a difference. There are some things that a fighter can deal with. There are some things that change a human being forever when it comes to striking. And me as a coach, I should know my fighter to know the difference when that is happening.
Thank you.
Oh, so a good example of this, the Rory McDonald fight is the bloodiest, most brutal thing that any of us
have ever seen.
But the difference in that fight, and for those of you guys, for those of you who haven't seen it, Rory McDonald versus Robbie Lawler is the single bloodiest event that you've ever seen. But it also is one of the most competitive fights you've ever seen. And I think that's where we see this dichotomy is in that fight. You've got a bloody, nasty mess where you could maybe make an argument that you should stop the fight because it's gross. And these fighters are not going to walk away the same in any way. There's going to be surgeries here. But in this case, you've got a fighter who had, I think what cements it for me is a guy who's turtled up waiting for this to be over.
Like, okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Casey. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's basically the point.
I'm looking at the fight metrics here. I'm looking at the fight metrics here. And in round three, Anthony Smith threw five strikes and landed one in round three.
He threw three and had two more to go.
He landed 12 strikes in the fourth round. Mm-hmm. He landed zero strikes in the fifth round.
Okay. Now, on the flip side of what Casey is saying, you can go back and look at the GSP versus Dan Hardy fight, where at the end of the fight, GSP had Dan Hardy's arm in a Kimura, and he was sitting on top of him, and he was twisting he was taking his arm to places that you only do with like G.I. Joe and Legos. Okay, he was literally twisting it all over the place, and Dan Hardy did not submit. Okay, and even then, when they were standing up and doing strikes, GSP was hitting him with straight jabs, the same jabs that he'd used to break Koscheck's orbital, and he still kept fighting. Now, after the fight, he never fought again. Dan Hardy never fought again. He still
kept fighting.
But he still kept fighting. Dan Hardy, number one, Dan Hardy still kept fighting, right? He was still producing offense, and that fight was competitive. Number two, Dan Hardy never fought again, not because of the damage he took from George St. Pierre. He never fought again because he had a heart defect, a heart valve problem. It was called Wolf Heart or something like that, right? And so
it's called GSP knee to the heart.
No, and so Dan Hardy never fought again for that reason. The fact is that Anthony Smith landed 37 strikes in the first round. He landed 36 strikes in the second round, 1, 12, and 0.
Big difference.
Yes, it was.
So you really have to then say, listen, and it's different if we had not watched Anthony Lionheart Smith go toe-to-toe with John Jones. It's different if we had not seen Anthony Lionheart Smith put legends to bed.
Mm-hmm.
So we know what Anthony Lionheart Smith is capable of. And when you see him not able to generate more than 12 strikes in an entire round, then you have to think that there's something wrong with our fighter. Maybe we should get him out. We're over an hour right now, and we're on the first topic of But that's what happens when you have two major cards in a week, right?
Yeah. I'm saying, you know, at bottom line, if the fighter and their corner got an agenda, and it's up to the ref to identify that, hey, they're not stopping it, I need to stop it. Okay, that's the ref's job. Okay, that is not Glover's fault. That is not Anthony's fault. It is the ref that needs to stop it. He is the arbitrary judge before anybody else in that ring. He is the guy that should have stopped that. I'm not mad at either fighter. I'm not really mad at the judge because he just said, "Well, let him bang." You know, he did a Mario Yamasaki.
We got to hit this next. I can't today.
All right.
Tell me about Tony Ferguson.
Yeah, let's talk about Tony Ferguson because he is another guy that was that was taking all kinds of damage, looking like a zombie in the ring when Justin Gaethje was just wailing on him, and finally the judge stopped that fight. I kind of want to know who the judge was for the Tony fight. Give me just 1 second. I'm looking that one up real quick. Because if it was Herzog, I'm gonna be like, "Yo,
this dude Dominic said was drinking."
Oh, it was Dominic Cruz that had. He was in Dominic Cruz's fight.
Keith Peterson.
That was Keith Peterson. Oh. Yeah. Oh, so okay. The Justin Gaethje fight had, drum roll please, Herb Dean. It was Herb Dean. Another one who likes to let him bleed. But anyway.
Yeah,
he does. He wasn't on his vigilante streak that night. Okay. He was like, "I let them lie. So I let them live."
Here's the thing. So we saw Tony Ferguson dancing in the hospital a week ago, we found out that he is not going to need orbital surgery. So therefore, he is likely going to be back in action sooner than we had expected. Although his coach, his striking coach, Rashad Holloway, says that Tony Ferguson needs a mental break from the sport following the UFC 249 loss. We know that Tony Ferguson is wound just a bit tighter than the rest of us. It's probably a good idea for him to take a little bit of some R&R.
I think it's important given that May is Mental Health Awareness Month. And so Tony, he does have some struggles. And let's be real, the mindset that he takes into the fight, the persona that he has to put on, it's a lot on him. And I think it's wise to take that moment, because not a lot of fighters have the Israel Adesanya mindset, which is, I'm stepping into this this limelight, this fight game is intense. And he works with a professional to keep his mind right. And I think it shows like how he's able to deal with the stress and bounce back and still maintain that fighter mentality without being overboard. So shout out to Tony for being in his corner, for being aware of the mental health aspect that comes into fighting.
Well, hold on, because just like with Tony, Israel, I don't know if you, just to clarify, Israel Adesanya, also when he became a champion, he got help to adjust to being a champion lifestyle. So, yeah. I mean, he's doing it too. So
yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm saying is that Israel came into before he even started fighting for the belt. He prepared himself mentally, knowing he was going to be in this position. And part of that mental preparation was working with a mental health professional. And I think that it's important that he talks about that too, because so many fighters don't talk about that mental health aspect of it. Mm-hmm. And he normalizes it when you get a champion who's like, look, yeah, this stuff is hard. Doing these interviews it's a stress. Like, they're required to be camera ready at all times. And as champion, that is only magnified. So I think it's wise that he's taking care of himself physically, emotionally, and spiritually. Like, it's that whole body champion.
All right. So someone who has had some challenges with you know, his mental health is Uriah Hall. We know that Uriah Hall is another person who is a phenomenal athlete, but sometimes gets too far inside his own feelings and gets too much into it. And the next thing you know, he's not able to perform. Well, he was supposed to be Jacare Souza's opponent at UFC 249, and it didn't happen. So they said he's in great shape. The next person they're calling out is Yoel Romero.
Oh, my Lord.
That was good. I heard it earlier. That was much better.
Improved. Oh, my Lord. Yeah.
So Uriah Hall's calling out Yoel Romero, the soldier of God. I actually am excited if that fight could actually happen, because you talk about two people who can go video game mode in a second.
That would actually work.
That would be an amazing fight.
If he beats him, will he do him like he did Luke Rockhold? Will he be trying to
kiss him because he's Judas?
I just want to give a shout out real quick, man. I see somebody came in online watching Coach Arjan Carlos Moreno out in California, man, over at Oakdale MMA. And I think he teaches at one other gym. I can't remember the name right offhand, man. But a major contributor to my life, major contributor to me as a fighter, as a coach, as all those things, man. I really miss that, man. I wish he was back in Texas. But if you're out in California, if you're in that area out there, anywhere from, I think it's from Oakland to Dublin to what else is out there? San Francisco, all those areas, man.
NorCal.
Coach Arjan, you need to go see him, man. One of the realest ones I know.
All right. Cool. Shout out to Coach.
Coach.
Also, this Yoel Romero fight. Crazy excited for that to happen because of the connections that my school has to the UFC. It's just crazy. So I fought someone who lost terribly to Yoel in the Olympics. And I used to walk around campus, and he was ranked, I want to say, like number 30th in for wrestling. And so every time I'd see him on the quad, I take him on a single leg and pin him and raise my hands like, I'm number 29 now. And, also, would not recommend doing that to someone who wrestled in the Olympics. They're crazy strong. Like, holy crap. But I kind of love these connections and the storylines that these fighters have. And what I like about this matchup is, like you said, both these guys have ridiculous levels of athleticism, and they put on a show. Like, they can turn into a video game real fast. But what I like about this is something that you hate about it, is that as much as both of them have their own individual storylines, their two stories don't cross in a way that the UFC can make this a pull your heartstrings story. Like, it just doesn't work. This has to be about the fight and fight styles and matchup. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is the purity of this particular fight. That if they can make this fight happen, there's no, oh, well, I feel bad for Uriah's got some stories where we can feel bad for him, but not in a way where you can just like make it, oh, well, Yoel didn't. So it comes to true martial arts in that matchup, and I love it. Like, I don't need the storylines. Like, I don't want like a Lifetime movie right before every fight, and like, oh, well, this guy's dog died in the third grade, and that's when he learned to throw a roundhouse kick. Like, that's a bit much. It's a bit much. Just give me two guys who are like video game level and finish him.
Yeah, there you go. You play 10-7, you're gonna watch this fight. That's just it.
Hey, we're going to back up just for Coach Arlen for a quick second. He wants to know what we thought about the Overeem fight. Ref should have stopped it, but let it go. He said, what's your thoughts? Compare that fight with the Dominic Cruz stoppage. So, George, I'm going to let you have that one first for you.
Well, I think you guys already know. I felt like Walt Harris had that fight wrapped up and that the referee should have stopped it originally when it went down. A lot of people are going to say, hey, you know, the comeback in itself says that, you know, the referee made the right call in not stopping that fight. But I disagree, as opposed to the Dominic Cruz fight. I felt like that one may have actually been stopped a little early in the same sense. Dominic wasn't taking the same damage that Overeem took from Walt Harris at that moment.
It's true. True. I agree with that. I don't think the Dominic Cruz fight was stopped early, though. I think that he was asleep the moment his head hit that cage. And the next strike that he took from Henry Cejudo was just insult to injury there. When you go back and look at the Dominic Cruz fight, you look at where his hand placement is on the mat, and it's the back of his hands on the mat. He's not posting up to stand. The back of his hands are on the mat, and that means he's out. He's taking damage, and he is not suited to come back and win that fight. So that's the only difference that I have from Mr. Stallworth's opinion.
I mean, it's not like the Sheik Kongo fight with the greatest comeback ever.
Pat Barry.
I agree with Ryan. There was too many unanswered hits in the Dominic Cruz Henry Cejudo fight.
As opposed to what in the Overeem and Walt Harris.
With the Overeem Walt Harris, there is this mentality that you've seen a champion fight, and whether I agree with it or not, when you see a champion fight, if they tend to let the champions fight a little bit longer and take a few more hits because they've seen them in crazy positions like that.
And now, Dominic Cruz is a two-time champion.
But hands on the ground. He was
bracing himself back to stand up.
With the back of his hands on the ground.
All right. Okay, he's bracing. George, this is what I want you to do. I want you to put your hands on the hands just like Dominic Cruz and try to get up and see if he could do so. All right.
I mean, that's coach. He can do anything.
Brace. Yes, I'm going to eat some shots in the meantime while I'm bracing to stand up. Meanwhile, tell me something. When Overeem was down taking those shots and he took a flurry of shots. Matter of fact, Dana even spoke about it for a minute. He said, hey, that flurry of shots from Walt. The big difference, well, he didn't say the difference in it, but basically what he was saying was that the shots didn't have the effect of putting him down in the same manner because of his size, his weight. Bigger weights are able to take shots a lot better than, say, guys at 135.
Right. So, and I don't like Dominic Cruz. Let's put it out there.
Okay.
Dominic Cruz was not out. If Dominic was out, then you, that definitely speaks to the Overeem fight.
He was looking like this. he was like this on the way down. I'm like, you are out, bro. Okay.
He was out. He was out.
You saw a camera frame picture photo, and I promise you, if you go back and look at the Overeem one,
I need that. And then the guy who took that camera shot should get a.
Johnny Hearns even calls right there. He said, Cejudo missed a lot of those punches.
I'm just saying, all right? We can go back and count punches, all right? But
back to what Carlos was saying.
Yes.
In comparison, though, no stoppages. Was one legit and the other wasn't? Were both stoppages legit or vice versa? Were both stoppages the wrong call? This goes back to something I talked about talk about on the show, was back to refereeing and judging. If you look back at this put it on display. These three fights in a series really showed the MMA community, showed the casual fan, and hopefully showed these commissions, because they got to look at and judge Florida as a commission as a whole and say, hey, maybe this is something we need to take a look at, because there were some very bloody fights that didn't get stopped at all, didn't even get a referee called in to look at a fighter, as opposed to there were fights that were stopped and there wasn't much damage being done whatsoever, and other fights that should have been called and were allowed to move on.
Yeah. Who was the ref for Dominic Cruz and
Keith Peterson?
Who was the ref for Walt Harris and
Herzog?
Different points of view. So in other words.
Let's go back. There was one other, Dan Mergliotta. Who was he referring?
Who was it?
Tony Ferguson.
I think it was Tony Ferguson.
No, he did the Walt Harris. He did the Walt Harris and Overeem fight, didn't he?
No, I'm looking now.
Dan Mergliotta refereed.
Dan Mergliotta. It had to be Dan Mergliotta because we were like, Dan Mergliotta, just he's not even standing in the right position. It was Dan Mergliotta. He was not even properly positioned to see Alistair Overeem with his eyes
rolled. Herzog was over the Tony Ferguson fight and Justin Gaethje.
Yep.
So
three different refs, and all of them are being called into question for the decisions they made or didn't make, or the calls they made or didn't call.
So basically, using a Star Wars reference, it was from a certain point of view.
I wouldn't say it's absurd. You've got different referees enacting their best judgment in these cases. And don't get me wrong, refereeing is a hard job. I'm glad Coach Carlos is online, because I've seen this man referee and had to make tough decisions and tough calls in fights. So him asking this question is kind of full circle for me in that sense. You got three different referees, and what you've seen is three different fights with outcomes that everybody questions. And you know these referees are doing the best that they can. These guys aren't there. They didn't get the call on that night and say, hey, show up, put on a black shirt, and do the best.
These guys
are veterans in the game. Go ahead.
Go ahead. You're saying everything I was going to say. They're not like Eve Levine Eve Levine.
Is a professional as well. They're not like Steven Mazzagatti. There you go.
Oh, come on.
Mario Yakisami is saying, I bet y'all miss me right now.
I know. Exactly. I know. Okay. Eve Levine was not a very good ref. Okay. Steve Mazzagatti, I would take him.
Steve
Mazzagatti, isn't he the one that got arrested for
No. He's not the one.
Who was the referee that got in trouble for some major crimes? Nobody remembers him now.
Josh
Rosenthal. It was Josh Rosenthal got busted from marijuana.
Josh Rosenthal?
Back in 2013, he got busted from marijuana. He got sentenced to 37 months for marijuana violation. Josh Rosenthal.
I thought there were some other charges involved. There was some major crimes involved in that, I thought. Maybe that's what he played down to.
Yeah, he had $6 million worth of marijuana with him.
He was
a mule. I believe that's what I'm reading snippets and headlines and things like that while we're on. But to Coach's point, that's what we thought. Clearly, it's controversial. What we need in the sport is more is a way to be able to understand the method behind the madness. That's the thing, is that as a casual fan, or even as a dedicated fan like we are, it's very difficult to understand the decisions that are being made by the referees and by the judges in these fights. And there really isn't a way for us to go and say, hey, this is the way that the rule is interpreted, and that's why the decision was made this way. And for us who follow the sport, who comment on the sport every week like we do, we really need more checks and balances, and we need more guidance as to how we should be viewing this fight, because clearly there's so much volatility between how one referee refs a fight versus another. We cannot allow a fight to be decided based upon who you have refing in the moment. I mean, we were joking about Herb Dean liking to see blood, but we know that Herb Dean's going to let you fight. Maybe Herzog, now that he's had that whole situation with Anthony Smith, he's not going to let the fight go down now. So you have that inconsistency from judge to judge, and that becomes
referee to referee.
I mean, sorry, referee to referee, and so therefore
judges as well,
but referee to referee. So now that becomes another opponent that you have in the ring. It's not just you and the person away across the ring from you anymore. It's the ref as well. It's the judges as well. We need the consistency in the sport. All right, let's go to the other fight that I was excited. Like, we were getting ready to get into. We were going through it. We were like, hey, Uriah Hall versus Yoel Romero. What kind of an amazing fight would that be? There is one fight that would be even more exciting than Yoel Romero versus Uriah Hall. You know who that would be?
Please share with us.
John Bones Jones versus Francis Ngannou.
Oh, Lord have mercy.
I'm excited for it.
You tell me that you wouldn't want to see that fight.
You have got, like, the single most skilled fighter on the roster moving up to heavyweight, giving so much more power. Because we've seen that John Jones is actually a lot stronger than his skinny legs give way to, like, he can deadlift close to 600 pounds. He squats on the regular over 400 pounds. Like, the dude puts it in the gym. So we know he's got some power behind him. Imagine if he's not cutting weight. Like, against the strongest puncher in the UFC, the most skilled versus the strongest. Like, this is a storyline of all things, like, not backstory, but, like, this is what you want to see in, like, stylistically matchup. That's what I should have said before Ryan hits me. But that's what I'm interested in, is, like, will power overcome here? And let's also note that Ngannou has been saying that he's got so much more he's wanting to show us.
Okay. He just never gets the chance, because the fight's over in 20 seconds. He doesn't get to show what he's got in his arsenal. Maybe he's a heavyweight John Jones. I'm not serious.
He's smoking on them tweeds.
Drinking that twine, smoking the tweeds.
Yeah. So, my thoughts on this fight, man. John Jones is too skilled of a fighter to let Overeem come out. I'm not Overeem. There I go. Blue. To let Ngannou come out and flurry him like that and catch him right off the gate. John has made a career of avoiding big punches like that. And we also, you guys don't get to see it very often, but John can take a shot from time to time. So I don't see Ngannou. Everyone has a puncher's chance, but it's going to take a lot of work for Ngannou to set up that big shot that he's going to need to land on John Jones. Meanwhile, John Jones is coming out like a lion in the jungle, stalking his prey, setting him up from the beginning and jumping out of the high grasses to you know, drop these shots that he needs to on Ngannou. If you go back and look at the John Jones versus DC fight, when he set up that head kick, that is John Jones, prime John Jones. And it's not even John Jones. That's his coaching setting that up.
About that.
That is his coaching set that up. And Ngannou doesn't have that same tool in his bag. He doesn't have the same coaching to teach him to set strikes up like that. Now, I do understand he's training with Mike Tyson now, but I don't understand whether or not Mike's in his corner, going to be there for fights and train him all throughout a camp. And that's going to be the big difference right there, is coaching that you see in that. So I give that fight to John Jones all day long.
Two things. You're right. it's not John Jones that's setting up those kills. It's the Winklejohn staff that's teaching. Because one thing, the beauty about John Jones, not only does he have a high fight IQ, but apparently he is very, very coachable. Okay, you can teach, you can tell him to do it, he does it. And that's what I've noticed about him throughout his entire career. He listens to his coaches. Now, I'm going to take Uncle Dana's stance on this is, I don't know if they really want to see each other in the ring. And that's what he said. He says, I don't think they really want to see each other in the ring. And I'm kind of agreeing with that. They could be just saber rattling. Because
This has to be real. Now, so you think about where Ngannou has left to go in the division, and his only shot is to fight for a title shot.
Yes.
The other thing is he needs a money fight. This is his money fight. Oh, when you look at John Jones, the division is boring. He could lose to Reyes if we're honest, if they run that back. Yeah. But there's really nothing else for him to do at that division, and it's not like they're going to give him an immediate title shot because DC's still in that mix. This is a great introductory fight to you're fighting a high-ranked guy. It's a great introductory into the heavyweight division.
And it sets up a title shot for either of those two. If Ngannou wins, it sets up his title shot. If John Jones wins, it's a pathway to that title shot and also that three-peat with DC.
There you go. And that's the whole point. Because it's looking more and more like there might be a stripping in the heavyweight division. If there's a stripping in the heavyweight division, it goes down to two fighters, and that's DC and Ngannou.
I'm in love with a stripper drop from
Here I go. Let me see if I can find it.
Exactly.
There's literally no one in that.
Don't get us pulled from YouTube. Don't play it.
Don't do it. But if it goes down to Ngannou and DC. It's a 50-50 chance that DC comes away with. I'll give it a 75-25 because that 25 equates to that bomb that Ngannou holds in his wrist. Okay.
I just want to be real here and highlight that John changed his position like from 0 to 100 real quick. Like this went to they're just talking and it couldn't happen to
I'm just saying, but if it does, I'm not saying I'm taking that simple. If they did do it, okay, and I'm saying that if it does happen, if DC beats Ngannou, guess what's gonna happen? Is what I've said all along. There will be a John Jones DC 3 lovers final return. Okay,
Mark my words. Nasty.
Mark my
words.
No. And I will. To y'all, so, that these two have an unrequited love affair, romance that is doomed from the start. Mark my words, this is how it's going to happen.
Are we getting the conspiracy?
Hit
music
my music, dog.
Yeah, we got the X-Files playing. John Keyes has been on this. There will be a John Jones DC 3 fight before DC leaves the sport.
Hold on.
It's been on again, off again. I mean, every time you say it's going to happen, it shows that it's not going to happen. Both of them said they're over it.
I told y'all DC Jones 2 was going to happen. I told y'all.
We all knew DC Jones 2 was going to happen. DC 3 ain't happening.
It's happening.
DC 3 will happen right after Khabib and Ferguson fight.
Then it ain't happening. Hey, so
it ain't over, people.
So
we
know that John Jones is the single greatest talent in the UFC, perhaps in the entire MMA world. He is, you know, largely considered undefeated. The Matt Hamill defeat is not held against him. But there's one place where John Jones is not a champion. There's one place where John Jones has more L's than Lowe, and that is, yes.
Oh, Mitch Hedberg.
See, thank you. There you go. and that is on Twitter, and John Jones. He was answering people on Twitter, and then he made a comment against Chael Sonnen, which is not wise.
Oh no!
You don't want to play the dozens with Chael Sonnen, and so he did.
He did take one W though.
He has, yes. John Jones has one W. That's the U in low. And so he's like, who is this? Has been now with man boobs making money off YouTube, getting hit talking about John Jones. That was him referring to Chael Sonnen. And Chael Sonnen then, because his fans started coming back and saying, you must be talking about Chael Sonnen. And John Jones affirmed it and said, hey, it took you about 25 seconds to figure that out. Impressive. And then, Chael Sonnen comes in. He's like, guy, you're the only fighter in UFC history with more mug shots than Al Capone. He says, you got more wrecks than Evel Knievel. He says, you got more gunshots than SEAL Team 6. He says, you got more boobs than David Crosby and Ernest Hemingway sitting on his shoulders. You got permanent handcuff creases in your wrists. You've been handed over more belts and shoelaces than a convention at Haberdashers. He says, you are the only fighter who gets asked for more pics from police photographers than starstruck fans. This is Chael Sonnen just going in on John Jones on Twitter. And he says, but that's on a rare occasion when a fan asks you for a pic, do you give him the side view out of habit? Chael Sonnen said, if you ever drive sober, the next works would cover it live with helicopters.
Don't mess with the American gangster, dude.
Then the last thing that Chael Sonnen said is, last thing. Everybody knows you beat this last case by ratting. Talking about the picograms.
Wow. I really wish called him out on everything and then at the end of it, called him a rat.
Chael Sonnen for the victory. Flawless victory.
I mean, not even Martha Stewart rolled over when she was facing time. I'm just saying.
Right.
Remember that. Remember that.
Well, but Martha Stewart's a gangster for real. Last thing, and then we're going to get out of here. Kevin Randleman is going to be inducted into the UFC Hall of Fame posthumously.
Amen.
So that's a great thing. I'm glad that we that they're doing that.
Why are you talking about last things? There's one fight I want to go back and recap on because he's local homegrown talent, and that is Kevin Trailblazer Holland, man. I don't know if you guys got to saw that because his fight was on the prelims. He fights at 185. I think he got a 39-second finish, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, wow.
Did you guys get a good look at that?
I didn't get to watch that fight, but I have seen Holland fight in the past.
Dude, keep your eyes on that young man. I really like him. And on top of that, his S-talking, his expletive talking.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate you.
It's high level. Yeah. So you don't have to go back and find a moment in this podcast where I did that. So you can
bleep it out. I know. Appreciate that. You just saved me an hour.
If you needed the time stamp on it, I could give you that too.
I'm not going to lie. I want to drop an F-bomb just to see what Ryan would do.
And that was the last episode. Kevin Holland. Last episode
Ryan,
of Kelechi on the show.
On top of it tonight. Look at you. So yeah, he fought Anthony Hernandez.
Mm-hmm. And it's a 39-second victory.
Those total strikes, 14-0. Wow, I didn't know that Anthony didn't throw anything.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. What night was the fight?
This was on
Saturday
night.
Saturday
night, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, again, gotcha. Keep your eyes on this young man. 185 division man, and he could probably float down to 170 if he really wanted to.
Nice.
All right.
I'm loving that local talent.
All right, as far as the Kevin Randleman induction, I implore people, there's a highlight reel of everything, of the destruction that he caused in the UFC on YouTube, look it up. And also pay attention to Kevin Randleman versus Fedor Emelianenko back in the Pride days. Awesome. Probably one of the best back suplexes that you'll ever see done to a person. He literally crunched Fedor on the mat. So I advise, look that up.
All right, but still, Fedor won that fight.
Crunched. His knee touched his nose. That's all I'm saying.
All right, well, follow us on social media. On Instagram, I'm at Combat Sports Talk.
And I am at Keys to Victory, and that's Keys with an ES.
Kelechi?
I am at Unfettered Joy.
Oh, wow.
That's
new. Wow. And, yeah, that's new.
Yeah.
Unfettered Joy. Is that
that was that
That sounds like a Match.com account or something.
I know, right? Are you a happiness consultant now? Is that what you are?
You know, when he's got the dashiki on, you know, you got to get the love.
I'm sorry, Ryan. You can't talk bad about
the doctor.
That's right. You can't talk about the dashiki, Ryan. Okay.
Oh, I'm not. That. I am showing nothing but love for the dashiki. Wakanda forever. And George?
You can find me either Geo Stallworth or George Stallworth or most mediums, but also Dark Side MMA on Instagram, ladies and gentlemen.
All right. You can also follow us at www.combatsportstalk.com. If you look to the top of our screen, these are all of the platforms that you can find Combat Sports Talk on. So like and subscribe. Follow us on Facebook. Follow us on Instagram, Twitter. Look for us on Apple Podcasts, Periscope, or Spotify. You can find us everywhere. Shout out to MMA Junkie, MMA Fighting, MMA Mania, Bloody Elbow, and the guys at the Intelligent Defense Discussion Group, where a lot of these conversations are first born that become on our show. And then all I got to say is, on behalf of John Keyes, George Stallworth, and Kelechi Onyebuchi, this is Ryan Smith reminding you to keep your hands up, your chin tucked, and throw bombs. We'll catch you next time.